Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday before the American Birkebeiner Ski Race. Organizers are watching the skies in Hayward, hoping for enough snow to hold America's largest Nordic ski race this weekend. Executive Director Ben Popp spoke with me yesterday by phone about their plans, whether or not the snow flies.
Yeah, you know, the Berkey were full on preparing for hoping to have a race on Saturday. It's, you know, all the infrastructure is in place to do half of the event from the north half, from the start line to 00, which is the midway point where there just is a little bit more snow in general on the trail. It's a little more north facing. We get some of the lake effect snow up there. And so we've been preparing that half right now. There's about 2 to 3 inches of snow on the trail, and it's 90% covered. So it's really close, but we need at least 3 to 4 inches to be able to have a safe event on Saturday. And so we're, you know, certainly we're really hopeful and excited earlier in the week when it was maybe 10 or 8 or whatever, and certainly now a little disappointed if it's 1 or 2. But we're ready, and we're just we're going to take whatever hand Mother Nature deals us.
Well, and what have you been hearing from people who have registered for the race, you know, that may have scheduled their flights or are traveling long distances to come because they do it every year?
Yeah, you know, they're excited. You know, the Berkey, obviously, it's a ski race, but it's so much more than that. People come and they go to the U.S.'s largest expo of ski retailers. They like to go downtown and have a beer and a brat on Main Street. They like to see friends. They go to the kids' events. And so all of those things are what make up the Berkey experience. And so while it's certainly a little disappointing if we can't do the ski race, we'll have some kind of Berkey event in 2017. And I think everyone's kind of excited about whatever it may be. It'll be one to remember.
So what's your backup plan? I heard that you might be doing your first ever run during the
ski race. Yeah, you know, I mean, if we get no snow, and, you know, first and foremost, we won't put people out on skis if we can't ensure that it's going to be safe for all 11,000 plus. And, you know, it might be safe for 100 or 500 or 800, but we need an event that's safe for 11,000, and that's a unique situation. And so if we can't do that, you know, if we consult with our medical team and the trail staff and security and the evac groups, if we don't feel that can take place, then we'll do something on the trail. And it could be, yeah, the world's largest pole hike or a trail run or something that involves the Berkey spirit out on the Berkey Trail. And then afterwards, we're going to have one of the biggest Berkey parties ever.
Might be more like a Tough Mudder, huh?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's actually not real muddy any longer. It was earlier on, but now the temps are below freezing. It's actually getting quite firm, and so we'll have to see what happens.
So how long can you afford to wait? I mean, when do you need to make that call of whether or not you're going to be able to put people on skis or not?
You know, it'll be Friday, midday. We'll wait as long as we can with still being able to give time notice for people that are, you know, trying to make plans for that next morning. And like I said, a lot of the people have made plans. You know, they've got to be here for 3 to 5 days with their housing and whatever they've got set up. And so a good majority of the folks are already arriving into town. And, you know, like I said, a lot of the festivities have begun, from the Birch Leggers groups to the World Open Breakfast and the like. And so, you know, from a ski standpoint, we have really until midday Friday to determine, you know, we'll see how the blob of green on the radar screen's looking, and hopefully it's coming our way. And if it isn't, well, then we'll begin. We've already begun looking at what our options will be if we don't get snow and how the logistics will play out. But at this point, we're still planning on snow arriving and going from there.
Well, and this all began back in 73 when you had just 35 skiers on the course. But how many times have you seen the event canceled or changed up just because, you know, Mother Nature doesn't
dump
it?
Yeah, you know, right. It's interesting because 9 times over the last 44 years, the event has either been shortened. It was canceled one time in 2000, but, you know, that's like 20 or 22% of the time. And it's actually been since 2007 that we've had to make an alteration or a change. And so, believe it or not, it's been almost 10 years. So as much as I don't care for statistics, unfortunately, this time we got to, you know, it might be time for us to be dealt a poor winter and poor ski conditions, unfortunately. But, yeah, so it's we're taking the hand we get, I guess, and we'll see what happens.
And how many people are you expecting in this weekend regardless?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, the last time they had to shorten it or, in, you know, do just a halfway ski or so, they had almost 75% of the participants take place in the event. So, you know, who knows? Like I say, we have 11,000 plus registered for the Berkey Cordy Prince Hokan on, well, it's now is all on Saturday. So, you know, I think we'll still have 8,000-10,000, depending on, again, kind of what happens with the snow and what we're able to do.
So any secrets to pulling any special strings to get the snow to come down?
Let me tell you what, we've tried everything from asking everybody up here to start sucking, see if we could pull that air mass north a little bit to, some ceremonial ritual prayers from the local native community out at Lacouderay to just downright saying a little prayer and hoping some snowflakes fall up here in the Northwoods.
Well, I guess we'll find out if anyone's listening up there.
That's right. That's right.
Well, anything else you want to add, Ben?
You know, at this point, all I can say is we're getting ready for a big old party and a big ski festival here in the Northwoods, and hopefully we'll see you in the Northwoods soon.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me and fill me in on what your plans are and what you've got on tap, regardless of what happens with the weather.
Well, no problem. Thanks for having me.
That was Ben Popp, Executive Director of the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation. Superior residents cast their votes for candidates running to become the city's next mayor this past Tuesday. Jim Payne and Brent Fennessy came out on top in Tuesday's race. The two candidates will now face off in the April general election, and Olivia Shalaby has more.
Douglas County Board Vice Chairman Jim Payne won 44% in Tuesday's race. Payne says the results were better than he expected. Payne says he wants to hear more from voters over the next couple of months about what they want for the city.
One of the most compelling things that I keep hearing from voters is that they want to make sure that this is a place that the next generation wants to stay. They want people to be invested in this community. Of course, everybody is concerned with the nuts and bolts of city life. We want better streets and we want lower taxes. That's important to people. But really, we want to be proud of where we live. And we want to believe that this is a fun place that we can continue to invest in and grow. And I think a lot of people are optimistic about that.
Superior City Councilor Brent Fennessy came in second with 28% of the vote. Fennessy says he also plans to get out there and talk more with people about their hopes and concerns. But he says the two have different views on how government should run based on their experience in county and city roles.
Although it's the same general process, they are run differently with different focuses, different goals, different everything. There's a lot of differences. And it's just a matter of, you know, finding those differences. I think both Jim and I want the best for Superior. I think that'd be fair to say.
Superior Planning Commissioner Kaylee Hermanson came in third in Tuesday's race, but she says she wouldn't have run her campaign any differently. Hermanson says she has no plans to run for public office in the future. She says voters should do their homework before the next election.
I would say just research your candidates and make sure you understand what they're all about, and definitely get out to vote on April 4th.
Superior City Councilor Mike Herrick couldn't be reached for comment. Around 14% of voters in Douglas County cast a ballot in Tuesday's primary. The general election will be held on April 4th. Olivia Shalaby, Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear about what Northern Wisconsin leaders lobbied for during the 32nd annual Superior Days in Madison this week. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us. This week, around 150 people from northern Wisconsin, including students, made the trek to Madison to lobby lawmakers and agencies for support on issues important to the north. Douglas County Administrator Andy Leshak, Douglas County Board Chair Mark Liebert, and Bayfield County Administrator Mark Abels-Allison spoke with me yesterday about their concerns for northern Wisconsin and what lawmakers had to say. Let's start off first off with the 2017 issues. There were a couple that were there from 2016, including one that you wrote up, Andy, which is the local option sales tax for roads. And, you know, yesterday, Senator Tom Tiffany was giving the keynote address to Superior Days, and he did not sound very optimistic. And so what are your feelings from talking to other lawmakers?
Well, our feeling, Mark and I, while we were down there, visited with 9 lawmakers outside of our lobbying team. So with total, we probably visited with 15 different lawmakers talking about this issue. They were very receptive, And I think where it's at right now, Danny, in regards to the budget process, is that it's early in the game. I think the majority party is trying to determine what position, what approach it takes. There's no feeling of consensus, even within the majority party, in regards to the Assembly and Senate compared to the governor's budget. So I think everything's open. And what we heard is that there has to be something done with transportation. We talked a little bit about the audit that was done on the Department of Transportation. We know that the challenges just the state has for fixing its own roads is pretty phenomenal. And I think when we started talking, refreshing the memories of some of the legislators in regards to AB 210, you know, they're looking at this saying, this is a compelling argument. It does a couple of things. It provides the local governments with local tools to fix local problems. This would be after a referendum. And the other thing that it does is it helps take the pressure off of the property tax. And I think one of the things that we heard down in Madison is there is a reluctance to raise taxes, especially the property tax. Wisconsin has gotten out of the top 10 in regards to highest property taxes, and I think people want us to stay out of the top 10. And so when we look at the local option sales tax for highway projects, by putting that on a sales tax that's used for specific purposes, we can help take the burden off of the property tax. Without the local option sales tax, the only tool that local government really has would be to bond. If we bond, the debt service goes on to the property tax.
Yeah, and I know that you've brought up the wheel tax as well, but that would come nowhere close to raising the kind of revenue that you need in order to repair roads.
That also had no support from the county board, so it's really off the table unless we were going to start that discussion again as a last resort. But at this time, it's not even on the table of our thoughts. We did have a meeting with Senator Tiffany after that disappointing backing in the speech, I guess, and we think we got a little bit of movement, and we convinced him maybe that there was more support out there for it. And I think I'm optimistic that he is going to take another look at it, and hopefully he'll move his position a little bit more towards our favor. It did seem to be that all the people, the legislators that we were meeting in, the meetings that me and Andy had were obviously with the ones that are writing the budget, so they were mostly Republicans. And a lot of them seemed interested in, did Tom Tiffany have support for this bill to move forward? So I know he's a key player in this, and we're going to continue to talk to him to try to get him to move to our position and be a champion for us, like he was on AB 210.
Well, and Chairman Liebert, I was surprised when you said that you are going to be bonding for $26 million. And I'm wondering over what period of time is that?
That's from 2015 to 2023. And the county board, when they established, and Chairman Liebert can talk about that, what they established highways as the board, as the county's number one priority, as part of our priority-based budgeting. And the need is even greater than what that bonding schedule is, but the board is really sensitive to the burden on the property taxpayer. So the schedule that we have in regards to the bonding schedule, which meets a construction schedule, that bonding schedule, the debt service from that bonding schedule would increase the property taxes by no more than 1%. It's actually between probably 0.75 and 0.9% a year. So the county board was really sensitive to the taxpayers, wanted to have a bonding schedule, a debt service schedule that didn't put an undue burden on the Douglas County property taxpayers.
And we're looking at about $100 million that we probably need on this. So $26 million is not going to be realistically get us out of this. And if we were able to, with this 0.5% sales tax, add another $2 million to that, you can see that we would start to make some progress. We have some huge projects coming up, Highway C and Highway Z, which are basically needed to continue to have forestry products move not only from our county out, but from Bayfield County, Sawyer County, Washburn County. They move their products through Superior, through Douglas County on those roads also. So these are major projects that that would cost more than we probably almost have budgeted over the next 5 years. So we're going to need some help building up other project numbers so that we can continue to fund those projects also.
Well, and I know Transportation Secretary Dave Ross, former mayor of Superior, said that that's really, they're looking at the state to solve that problem. I guess that remains to be seen, you know, with the difference of opinion between the legislature and the governor as far as whether or not we should raise taxes or fees.
Danielle, is it okay if I share just a couple of thoughts on the transportation issue?
Oh, yeah, please do.
Yeah, I think both Andy and Mark have shared an excellent summary. And I think what they said at the beginning was that we're early in the process. And Craig Thompson with the Transportation Development Association has led a campaign across the state over the past 12 months called Just Fix It. And that's not unique to Northwest Wisconsin, but it's across the entire state, and it's saying, hey, we need to address our infrastructure needs. Bayfield County, just like Douglas County, has said that transportation is, and our road infrastructure is the number one priority. But I think what is unique is Northwest Wisconsin and Superior is coming together and saying, hey, you know, we want to find a solution, and here is a solution that we've come up with. So it's, I think, in line with the TDA's Just Fix It campaign, and everybody's trying to provide different suggestions, whether it's finding additional dollars through the audit, whether it's the sales tax, whether it's the wheel tax, whether it's some other mechanism. But it just stresses the importance of that transportation infrastructure and our true need and desire to fix it. And if we can't fix it with state resources, the local communities in Northwest Wisconsin has said, okay, we don't like it, but it's so important that we're willing to fund that ourselves through a sales tax on our communities.
I think that we sense the frustration with the legislative. I mean, they are kind of feeling the pressure also that they haven't been, that the governor hasn't been coming up with a solution. And I think they were receptive to us trying to find that solution and maybe incorporate it into a bigger picture, because I think ultimately they now recognize they may have to figure out a transportation fix for the state, because they heard the same thing we heard from Dave Ross, that at least it didn't appear that there was a salvation in what they were going to do for us or anybody else in the state. So I think that Mark Abels is right over there, that there's a movement in the state to try to fix this, not just in northern Wisconsin. That Just Fix It campaign, every county in the state basically had a meeting on the exact same night. That's a big thing. I mean, that's a big message to the legislator, to saying you need to solve this, and you haven't so far, and you have to address it. So, and I think that they're starting to get that message.
Well, and after all the resources from the federal government that may have been there during ARRA, or the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, I was surprised to learn that only 30% of that money actually went to transportation projects, and that the other 70% went to balancing budgets. I mean, that underscores some of the challenges that everyone was facing during the recession, but now that we're out of it or coming out of it, what can be done? And I'm very curious if the legislature will take action despite the governor's feelings, and maybe we might see like some sort of veto override vote. But Mark, Administrator Abels Allison, I wanted to go to you about some of the things that were brought up for Bayfield County as far as one issue in particular that you have been bringing down for years, which is payment in lieu of taxes, or the acreage share payment for lands that are enrolled in county forest or under the county forest law. Why is this so important to towns in your county?
The county, as you noted, this isn't the first year, but we've raised it a number of times, and it goes back to the importance of forestry in the state of Wisconsin. And forestry is the number two industry. It's critical for our manufacturing economy, our industrial economy, and it's also critical for jobs up in northwest Wisconsin. Statewide, there's about 2.4 million acres of county forest, and these are lands enrolled in county forest law, so they're dedicated, they're committed to a managed forest that supports the forestry industry in the state. In northwest Wisconsin, we have over a quarter, in our four counties, we have over, I think it's 27% of the total forestry acreage is in our four counties. It's over 700,000 acres. And every one of those acres is owned by the county, and so by definition, the county doesn't pay taxes. There's a certain portion of the timber proceeds that are returned to the, or shared with the towns in each county. But in addition, as a commitment to supporting the forestry industry, the state has, beginning in 1929, they established a fee that was paid to counties on an acreage basis. So right now, on an annual basis, towns with county forest lands receive 30 cents an acre. That started in 1929. In 1953, it jumped up to 20 cents an acre. In 1989, it jumped up to 30 cents an acre, and it hasn't changed since 1989. So we've been at 30 cents an acre since for 28 years now. In comparison with adjacent states, the state of Minnesota, they have a slightly different system, a different collaboration between the county and the state, but counties there receive $1.50 per acre. In comparison with the federal PILT, so those lands that are owned or that are national forest lands or other national lands, they provide $2.50 approximately per acre to local units of government. And then if you look at the state payment in lieu of taxes, the state itself for their own lands, they pay an ad valorem tax amount, which varies based on the mill levy, and it varies based on the value of the property, but it's usually well over $10 an acre.
Well, and Mark, I know that this almost went through like a year ago, but it was tied to a managed forest law bill, and so it kind of got caught up in the politics, and the increase in acreage share payments didn't go through. What kind of sense do you have that this might happen this year?
I think it's always a struggle. I think what we're trying to do is stress that forestry is critical to the state, and that towns are bearing some of the burden, and we don't want it to be a burden. We think forestry is a tremendous asset, but towns are providing essential services. They're providing the road infrastructure in their towns. They're providing emergency services, fire and ambulance, and we're trying to see that that they get reimbursement or they get funding that allows them to provide those services at a safe level.
I want to kind of go back to PILT and talk a little bit about what makes Superior Days such a special and unique lobbying effort. Of course, it's the gold standard for citizen grassroots lobbying in Wisconsin. But one of the things that really makes us different is the fact that we also bring students down to Superior Days. And this year, Mark, I believe there were 50 students from around not only the counties of Ashland, Bayfield, Douglas, but also Washburn County and I believe Iron County. And when it came to the PILT issue, and this is what was so unique, we had a sophomore from Washburn High School, Ryan Meeker, who handled that issue. And so here you have a sophomore speaking about a pretty complicated issue. Mm-hmm. Two legislators that some of them serve on the Joint Finance Committee. And it was really neat to listen to Ryan bring up this issue, talk about it. He lives in Bayfield County, one of the counties with one of the largest county forests. And I think it kind of hit home about the importance of this whole grassroots lobbying, that these issues hit home. They not only impact us adults, but they also impact students who will one day hopefully be future leaders within our counties.
When we were lobbying a little bit for that, the funding for that was on a mill tax, a 1% mill tax that the entire state of Wisconsin paid on their property tax. And it was a fund dedicated to not only, there were other issues that they paid with because they collected more money than they did just for the PILT program. But it ended up, there was a dedicated source that was going to pay that PILT. And in the last budget proposal by Governor Walker, he's actually proposed to eliminate that 1% mill tax, which then raises a very valid question. Where is that money going to come from to not only pay for the increase in the PILT tax, but the 30-cent PILT tax, in my estimation, is now maybe at risk. We know it's going to be funded this year because there's dedicated money in the DNR budget, but by statute, the DNR is required to pay that money. Now, they're going to lose that funding source. So we may be faced with a different argument at our next Superior Days on what happens with this PILT program.
Right. The governor has proposed eliminating the forestry mill tax, and that would provide about a $90 million property tax cut. I think the average homeowner would see around $69 or $70 on their bill in savings. I know that the Wisconsin County Forest Association is working on this, trying to understand what the language means. I mean, the governor has said that funding would be backfilled with general purpose revenue, or basically state funds. But I think there's a lot of uneasiness as to how that would affect the forestry account and projects moving forward, if that money's going to be there.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, and are there any other issues that each of you wanted to touch on more specifically?
The Exposition District.
Yes.
The most exciting issue we brought down.
Well, and it sounded like that has been treated very favorably by at least Hazelhurst Republican Senator Tiffany. Mm-hmm. He said that he would be willing to advocate for that, which I think it was surprising to me after hearing of Republicans saying that, you know, no new taxes or fees. I mean, essentially, this would allow you to tax food and beverage specifically for that area.
And here, I think, is the is our gateway to get both, in light of the environment and the mantra about no new taxes, here's our gateway to get both the Exposition District changes passed and also the local option sales tax passed. All we need to do is look at Rhinelander and their success in getting the premier resort designation last year. That was something that was the legislature passed and the governor signed. We're asking for the same thing. A referendum by the citizens would have to approve any new tax, and that tax would sunset unless reauthorized by a referendum of the citizens. So what we're asking for is nothing new, nothing that the legislature hasn't done recently, nothing that the governor hasn't signed into law recently. We're asking for the same thing. So I think that gives us that doorway in light of the discussion and the mantra about no new taxes.
And I think that we were successful when we tied those two issues together, because instead of just a road issue or a convention center issue, it became a future of Douglas County and Superior issue, an economic development issue, that we needed both of these things in place so that we could move the city forward, that we were losing too many people to Minnesota, not only as tourists but residents. And their debt development over there is just unbelievably different than ours. And to give us both these issues to try to further our own well-being in the state of Wisconsin, I mean, the Governor Walker is all for development over here and more housing and more business and the rest of them. And we tied these both. This isn't a road issue. This isn't a convention center issue. This is an economic well-being of our area issue, so that we can continue to try to keep our people that we've invested all this education dollars in living in our area and building houses in our area. And I think we were successful, and I truly believe that the Republican caucus is looking at solutions, and I think they'll seriously consider both of these. And I think the Expo Center is probably the best. I was asked by a staff member if we could only have one, which one would we have? And I said they're tied together. We can't make that decision. We really need both of these as a tool for us to move forward into the next generational well-being, I guess you would say. And I think they respected the fact that we didn't choose size and say, we're from Douglas County, we just want the highway issue. Or we're from the Expo District and we just want that. So I think they got the point that we're trying to tie these together to economic development for our area.
Well, thanks, gentlemen. I'm sorry I ran over on time. I appreciate you taking the time to talk about Superior Days.
Thank you.
Again, you were just listening to Douglas County Administrator Andy Leshack, Douglas County Board Chair Mark Liebert, and Bayfield County Administrator Mark Abels Allison about the 32nd Annual Superior Days held in Madison this week. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from one author about finding herself in the story of race and white privilege. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Debbie Irving was a featured speaker in a diversity summit held at UMD this week. She's the author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. She joined me by phone recently to talk about her book and her journey to understanding white privilege. I'm really glad that I have a chance to talk to you about this topic in your book, Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race, because this is something I feel a lot of people who are white have been struggling with. Ever since, well, for, I guess forever, but it, more specifically since the Ferguson, Missouri incident, where we've seen racism kind of thrust back into the spotlight, where maybe some parts of the population thought, oh, we had already dealt with that. We had the civil rights movement. Aren't things better now? And your book kind of goes through your personal journey of growing up white and realizing what it's like for white people to not have to deal with what other races or cultures have to deal with, and the privilege that's afforded. And so thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this topic.
Oh, it's my favorite topic in the world to talk about.
Can you kind of describe a little bit of your journey and how this all came to be, where you realized some of the things that made it difficult to understand race and the social construct of racism and things like that?
Well, I think the most, what made it harder than anything was that without understanding that I had been put into a socially engineered all-white world, I grew up in an all-white world. And so I grew up in a suburb of Boston, Winchester, Massachusetts, a very affluent suburb. And I would have assumed that anybody could move there. You know, I grew up on the narrative that all you have to do is work hard and reach the American dream. And in my white world, that was very true. There were many families who had stories about my great-grandparents came to America with 2 cents in their pocket. They didn't speak a word of English. They were treated like dirt. Look at us now. And so this whole melting pot idea was a very beautiful idea to me. And it never occurred to me that that American dream or the idea of in a generation or two really being able to find social and economic stability, it never occurred to me that that attainment was not accessible to everybody, or if it was, there were multiple obstacles that people had to jump over that white families like mine didn't. So because I was in an all-white world, the only narratives I ever heard, the only family stories I heard, the only were white. And then you think about the other ways that young people get information. It's through television shows, movies, textbooks, novels, cartoons. Everything that came at me was information had been created by white people who were also coming out of a white mindset. And so without realizing it, I was really growing up in a hall of mirrors with no understanding that, A, that was happening, or B, the stories I wasn't hearing.
Yeah, and you talked about how there were differences for, you know, children or children of color growing up and your own upbringing. And you talked about how your parents sought to protect you from all the evils or harms of the world, whereas children of color or minorities growing up are taught things like, if you see a police officer, make sure to keep your hands in front of you, or, you know, don't go to a white neighborhood alone to avoid any uncomfortable situations.
Yes, and another one of the ones that I find kind of heartbreaking is if you're, for children of color, when they go to a white dominant neighborhood for a play date, if they do, they're told never play hide and seek outside because there's too high a chance that someone will think that you're sneaking around and it could get you killed.
This topic is so interesting to me because I think it's difficult for a lot of white people to have conversations that are taking place right now about race and racism and some of the things that may need to be addressed in order to bring equity or equality. And in one of the things that you talked about in your book, another example that you gave was this example of a young white man who was trying to get ahead, who had grown up poor and needed money for school, and he ended up shoplifting and stealing to make his way through college and was only caught one time. But you gave this other example where we have this educated African-American author, celebrated historian, John Hope Franklin, who received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Clinton. And then when he went out to a club one night, a very exclusive club in Washington, D.C., was approached by a white woman who gave him her coat check tag.
Yes.
And, I think it's like those kinds of events where if the color of a person's skin were changed, our reaction to those situations are different.
Right. So not only did I not know that would be called a microaggression, what happened to John Hope Franklin. It's one small moment in a person's day, but it happens multiple times a day, every single day, every year, generation after generation, to most people of color. So not only do I not know that the person of color is experiencing those moments, but I can't imagine, I don't know what it would feel like. It's a little bit like trying to describe what giving birth is like. You can describe it all you want, but if you don't live it and you can't feel it, I think it's very hard to understand. So the best I can do is earn the trust of a person of color, and if and when they choose to trust me enough to share that kind of a story with me, I can try to not only hear it and believe it, but to imagine feeling it. You know, when's the time I have been misunderstood or insulted to that degree? And it's hard to find in my life, it's hard to find those moments for to imagine what it's like, but it's important to try to.
Right, because being white, people are afforded so much privilege in society. There's just a lot more convenience and comfortability because the way that our society has operated for the last 200 years. Given that we built a nation on slavery. And, you know, I wanted to ask you about this list that you have in your book. One of the things you talk about is the lack of privileges or discrimination. I think you referenced Dr. McIntosh. Is that right?
Peggy McIntosh. It's an essay called Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack of White Privilege.
And you have this list, and some of the things on this list are, I can go shopping alone most of the time, pretty well assured that I will not be followed or harassed. I can be sure that my children will be given curricular materials that testify to the existence of their race. I can swear or dress in secondhand clothes or not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to the bad morals, the poverty, or the illiteracy of my race. And that's just shocking to me. I mean, you know, it kind of speaks to, for example, like if there were a white criminal who robs a bank, no one would make the assumption that all white people are bad because of this one man that robs a bank. But if a Native American or a black person or a Muslim commits a crime, it seems to be immediately generalized to the entire race or religion.
Right, and we don't even have to get hypothetical about that. We can think about, you know, Timothy McVeigh, who masterminded the Oklahoma City bombing, and it wasn't seen as a problem of white men, or Dylann Roof, or, you know, we have a lot of mass shootings that have happened by white men, and yet it isn't seen as an inherent characteristic of white men. It's seen as a problem of that individual.
Well, in your book, you talk about how you came to this awakening of all these things that you just didn't realize, that you didn't realize about systemic racism or racial constructs. And can you go into that a little bit?
All the things I didn't realize about racial constructs and systemic racism? Wow, okay, that's a PhD kind of question. So the best example I have, I'll go back to growing up in this beautiful suburb, Winchester, Massachusetts. As I said, I would have thought it was available for anybody to live in. It turns out that in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, banks were issuing loans based on a mapping scheme so that they literally laid out maps of the areas they were lending in, let's say Boston, Massachusetts, or Greater Boston, Massachusetts. And they would outline in red neighborhoods where black and brown people lived, exclusively or predominantly, and they would outline in green areas that only white people lived. And then there were two other colors, a yellow and a blue, that they would have as gradations that were a combination. The practice is called redlining, and banks often would not issue a loan in any neighborhood other than a green neighborhood, which means populated exclusively by white people, or if they did, there would be a seriously, much higher interest rate to loan into what they would consider not as safe a neighborhood. And where were the banks getting this idea? This was from the Federal Housing Authority, which issues guidelines to lending institutions across the United States. And in the FHA guidelines, it said, hey, banks, when you're making a loan, consider two things. Consider the condition of a building that someone wants to purchase. That makes sense to me, because who wants to invest in or make a loan into a building that's going to be falling apart? But the second criteria that the Federal Housing Authority had written in its guidelines is consider who lives in the neighborhood, and it said the presence of even one or two non-white families can undermine real estate values. And that is why that redlining, that map color coding process, it's called redlining. That is why the practice of redlining was created, so that for that, and you think about the implications of this. If we're talking about the 1940s, we've got World War II veterans coming home and trying to access the GI Bill benefits package, which provided free higher education and government-backed interest, low interest rate loans to go buy a home or start a small business. Well, that GI can't use the housing portion of the loan because the government is only willing to loan in a white-only neighborhood. So, for instance, my father was in World War II. He came home. He went to Harvard Law School for free. And then my parents bought their first home in Winchester, Massachusetts, for $17,000. Black and brown GIs were not able to do this. And so that house my parents bought for $17,000, they sold 40 years later for $1 million. So when you look at the wealth gap today, you have to think about the systems, the racialized systems that have made it easier for white people to access wealth and resources. So, and to put some scale to this, the GI Bill alone in their housing program pumped $120 billion in 1940s dollars. I don't know what it would be in dollars today. $120 billion from government coffers into the hands of private citizens through the housing portion of the GI Bill. And 98% of that went to white GIs, even though there were 1.2 million black GIs. There were also Latino GIs, indigenous GIs, and Asian GIs who had equally risked their lives in World War II, came home and were barred from accessing those benefits. So that's an example. So I think I'm just growing up in Winchester, Massachusetts. Little do I know that there's been a government infusion of cash into that town. And you think about, how's education, public education supported, budgeted in this country? Well, it's through property tax. And so the property values in those white-only neighborhoods is extraordinarily higher than in a redlined area. And so now not only do we have disproportionate access to housing, lending, we've got disproportionate access to educational opportunity and also transportation choices, food supply, medical care, the list goes on. So that's a snapshot of what systemic racism looks like.
Well, you talk about this culture of niceness, where you grew up in the surroundings where you either internalized or avoided conflict because that was what was considered normal in your family. Can you talk a little bit about how that plays a role in interrelations?
Well, yeah, and you think, so avoiding conflict avoidance went way beyond race and racism. So we had a saying in my family, never discuss, in polite company, we don't discuss politics or religion. And you couldn't even begin to talk about racism at any level, any kind of a deep level, if you didn't understand the political and religious underpinnings to it. So I grew up in a very superficial kind of a world, and we didn't even know how to navigate conflict and interpersonal relationships. A big comment was, well, we'll just agree to disagree, as opposed to really lean in and dig in and work through interpersonal conflict and get to some kind of a reconciliation or resolution. So there's a lot of cold shouldering that went on in my childhood. So that left me with really zero conflict navigation skills when conflict erupted in my adult life, in my marriage, with my siblings, with cousins, with friends. And, of course, now we bring in the explosive, potentially explosive topic of race. Well, I don't want to go anywhere near it. If I've been taught not to avoid conflict, the last thing I want to do is get onto a topic that's almost 100% sure to create that kind of tension that I associate with conflict. And so for years, it kept me from asking questions that might have allowed me to learn. I didn't ask those questions because I was afraid I would look ignorant or I might offend someone, which would, in either case, it would create an inner or outer conflict, and I wasn't willing to go to either of those places.
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up because I think that's what a lot of people feel, is that fear of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing unknowingly or knowingly, you know, when you're having conversation about what's happening in the news, whether it's Black Lives Matter or police shootings or anything right now, people tend to back away from that. They have their private opinions, but out in public, they just don't know how to have those conversations or what to say or what to do to connect with people on a person-to-person level.
And think about, you know, this is what I didn't understand, is what a privilege it was to have the choice to walk away and not talk about it. Because for me, it's a choice. Do I or do I not engage in conversations about race and racism, the history of that in our country? Whereas it is, you have to in order to navigate this world if you are a person of color. And if you want to change the status quo in this country, which is there are a lot of stereotypes and biases that aren't discussed. There's a lot of history that hasn't been reported. If you want to change that as a person of color, you have to talk about it. So it isn't a choice. And by the way, I think the most liberating moment for me came when I realized that the reason I was uncomfortable had to do with my own ego. I was afraid I would look stupid, but the stakes for a person of color choosing to engage cross-racially and talking about these issues, I mean, historically, that's been a matter of life or death. So what's at stake for me is, am I going to look stupid? And what's at stake for the person standing across the room from me is, if I speak up, I might be killed. I might be ostracized by my community. I might lose a job. I might not be rehired. And so when I realized how different the stakes were around comfort for people based on racial identity, I thought, wow, you have got to get over yourself. In fact, there's a chapter in my book called Getting Over Myself because it was such a profound moment for me. And so, you know, for people hearing me, what you haven't heard a lot is the degree to which I acknowledge how much I've internalized ideas around white supremacy, that I basically was socialized in a beautiful, friendly, happy neighborhood and family, I was socialized around white supremacist values without understanding it. And once I recognized that, wow, not only can you say that out loud, Debbie, but you need to, because you didn't ask for this. This is a historic pattern of the way we've all inherited and we're all born into a set of beliefs and customs. And by the time we're old enough to say, what happened? It's in us. And so saying what happened is really important, and doing it without a lot of shame but with curiosity is an incredibly powerful journey to put yourself on. That's the journey I put myself on. And writing about that journey is what Waking Up White is.
Well, thank you so much, Debbie Irving, author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. Really appreciate you talking about your book and all the things that you learned today.
Thank you for having me on.
That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website, along with extended interviews with Debbie Irving and the Superior Days crew at wpr.org/superair. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.